Denjo is willing to take questions during the talk. If you have any questions, you can just directly unmute yourself and then ask Denjo. And then we can also take questions at the end if there are any. So Denjo, please take it on.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation to the perimeter, even though I'm visiting only virtually. So it's nice to be back. Today I'm going to talk to you about testing gauge gravity duality with matrix models. I will not say that much about the gravity side. My focus will be mostly towards the matrix model, the quantum field theory side of this. And you've seen my abstract already, so I'll go on. And one of the principal models that I want to discuss, and it's really a family of models, is the Berkus-Douglas model. It dates from 96. And if you're not familiar with it, basically, n equals one supersymmetric Yang-Mills in six dimensions, dimensionally reduced to time, toroidal compactification, if you wish, and just removing all the massive modes. Or you can take it to be n equals two in four dimensions. It was introduced by Berkus and Douglas to attempt to describe M5 brains with M2 brains, longitudinal M5 brains. There's a more general setting which one could try to describe, which is DP plus four, an intersection of those objects. I won't go into that today. So I'm just going to write down the model first of all and start discussing it. It is related to other models. It's the BFSS model with some scalars and some additional fermions. Basically, it's a vector multiplet. The BFSS model is a vector multiplet and an adjoint multiplet, and you add to that a fundamental multiplet. I've written it here, just the bosonic sector of the model. And the A is running from one to five, so it has SO5 cross SO4 symmetry. But one important feature of this model is that it admits massive deformations. And these were discussed by Kim Yee and Park in 2002. The BFF, I'm just going to begin by focusing on the BFSS to BMN case and this family of models. In that case, the X5 component, this Hermitian one, mixes with two of the four SO4s and to get an SO3. And there's a massive deformation that's allowed in that case. And the parameter for the massive deformation is denoted mu. And I've written out the BFSS model with that massive deformation, which you should recognize as the BMN model. One of the nice aspects about it is that it is that if I take mu to infinity, it reduces to a purely Gaussian model. The dominant terms are those in blue. The other interactions are subdominant, and it effectively becomes a supersymmetric gauged Gaussian model. I'm going to begin by discussing the physics of this particular Gaussian model, a gauge Gaussian model. And I've written out a gauge Gaussian model with D scalar fields. It's an almost trivial model. However, it's not quite trivial in that it's a system of harmonic oscillators with a Gauss law constraint. The Gauss law constraint insists that the physical states are SUN singlets, So you can create physical states by taking traces of matrices of creation operators. And these are called individual traces, single traces are called often called words, and multiples of these are called sentences. And one can treat the model in some detail by understanding that aspect of it. But we can qualitatively understand what's happening in the model by just considering its individual components. And I'm going to take mostly a path integral approach to this. The eigenvalues of the matrix Xi, in this case, are always described by a Wigner semicircle. The gauge constraint has very little impact on those. So this is one of these matrices would be the famous matrix quantum mechanics model of the 70s. And at temperature zero, the gauge field can be gauged away. It's trivial. While at large temperatures, we get a dimensional reduction to a zero dimensional model, pure matrix model, and the gauge field A becomes one of the matrices. So at some point, as we increase the temperature, one would expect that the gauge field becomes important. And when that happens, it happens suddenly in a phase transition. The transition can be observed as center-symmetry breaking in the Polyakov loop. So one can use that as it's observable. It's closely related to confining-deconfining transition. And as we will see, it has it's basically described by a Hagedorn phase transition. More generally, well, I've just had a comment at the bottom. Oh, where am I gone? Sorry. More generally, these bosonic matrix models with interactions are very well approximated by this gauge Gaussian model. Their low-lying states are. If there are any questions, maybe I can ask if anyone wants to interrupt and ask a question at this point. If not, I will continue. So analyzing the gauge Gaussian models, one can integrate out the XA, the matrices XA. There are D of them, as I said. And one gets the energy, the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator, of D harmonic oscillators. They're matrices, N squared by minus one. I've taken traceless matrices times beta M. And then there's a sum of the terms involving the eigenvalues of the field, of the gauge field beta, and I've taken theta to be the eigenvalues of beta A in the static gauge. This term here is the van der Mond from the change of variables in the measure. One can get it by gauge fixing as well. You can have your favorite way of doing it. It acts as an eigenvalue repulsion theorem. As you can see, there's a minus sign here that says that if these two objects are close together, then there's a strong repulsion between when the log gives us logarithmic repulsion between the eigenvalues. If we expand the logarithm in the it can be regrouped. And these double sums can be grouped together, and we get it as an action in terms of these variables un. And takes this rather clean form. And the un are moments of the distribution of eigenvalues of theta. So we're basically expanding it in its Fourier modes in terms of un. And with these coefficients giving the thing. So if we examine this term for a moment, you can see that at low temperatures, when beta goes to infinity, this term is absent, and we get a one here. And basically the ground state of these UNs, we can think of this as an effective action for the UNs, all of the UNs have a minimum at zero, and the free energy is given by the 0 point term for these. This constant just came from that rearranging. As the temperature is increased, you can see that the leading exponential is the n equals one term, and that leading exponential means that that as the temperature is increased to some particular value, which I've written here as beta h, this is the inverse temperature, the U1 becomes unstable. It develops a negative mode. There's a tachyonic type mode for it. So it develops a non-zero expectation value. And this is this happens at a Hagedorn transition. One can understand it as a Hagedorn transition from the word counting, in that the number of states blows up at this value. Now, in the large N limit, the free energy can be written in terms of eigenvalues for this eigenvalue density, and we get the free energy as a double integral of over the objects that were of these functions that we had with eigenvalue repulsion from the van der Mond and the potential with e to the minus beta m. For low enough temperatures, and this includes the transition, expanding in e to the minus beta m, we can expand the first term and just keep the first term. So we get then. We can go back and interpret the model. This is the free energy written at the bottom here. If I do that, and you can translate it back, and you can see that you're really dealing with a matrix model, which is an integral over unitary matrices. This term here came from the change of variables diagonalizing the matrices, and one can treat it with an arbitrary A1. One of the advantages of this is that if I put the model on a lattice, the basic thing that changes here is A1 becomes lattice dependent, and one can analyze it in gory detail as one wishes. Another feature that happens, of course, is that the ground state energy is lattice dependent. We'll see that in a second as well. So let's see. The eigenvalue distribution, and this is, I'm referring to a Haroni et al. In 2003 worked out, they derived this eigenvalue distribution. It's given by a constant in the low temperature phase. This is the confined phase. And it's given by this distribution, which is basically a Wigner semicircle. If you change variables to sine theta over 2, you will convert it into a Wigner semicircle in terms of the variable x, which is sine theta over 2. And that describes the high temperature phase. And we have a phase transition between these two at when theta naught becomes pi and s becomes 1, and that occurs when beta is beta h. So this is the Hagedorn transition. The free energy, we can plug back into our formula for the free energy, this eigenvalue density, and calculate the free energy. It gives us a constant in the low temperature phase, characteristic of a confined phase, and this is our ground state energy. As we increase the energy, the temperature, it suddenly jumps to the deconfined phase in a Hagedorn transition. Near the transition, we can expand this free energy, and we see that there's a linear term, and there's a three halves non-analyticity in the eigenvalue distribution, in the free energy. This is significant. If we look at the I've jumped way ahead. if we look at the Hagedorn transition, we can look at the internal energy, the internal energy E. And this, again, is just given by the ground state energy. And the square, we reduce the 3/2 to a square root singularity. And one can plot these, the graphs. This is the curve we've been looking at here, the green one. And put it on the lattice, you see, this is a lattice of size 40 lattice points. And there's a shift in the ground state energy. This is a lattice dependent effect. And you can see that the dominant contribution or dominant effect here is actually that you're mismeasuring the lattice, the ground state energy. The ground state energy has the dominant dependence on the lattice spacing. If one looks just to examine that ground state energy, I've just plotted it from the transition downwards. You see it becomes quite significant down to, once we get to quite low temperatures, once we're down to temperature 10 or 5 and down to 10, it's there are very significant lattice effects. This is a serious problem for continuing for the models that one one's interested in simulating them at very low temperatures, where the gauge gravity duality should hold. Are there any questions at this point? Okay. Now, if we look at the specific heat, what it tells us is it tells us about fluctuations in the system. You will typically have fluctuation will tell you if the specific heat is large, you have a good chance of jumping between one state, energy level and another if the gap is less than the specific heat. And what you see here, the specific heat actually diverges. That's that square, that 3/2 power in the free energy is feeding into the specific heat, and it diverges as one approaches the Hagedorn temperature. And you can see that that's actually quite well reproduced by the simulations, that type of single of thing here. But you wouldn't recognize it purely from simulations. One would need some analytics to be able to establish that this was the case. However, when one looks at the specific heat as an observable, one will see that the fluctuations are large. If this is a genuine feature of the physics of something, that the specific heat gets large, then one expects to see very large fluctuations. This is the type of thing that's very characteristic of a continuous or second order phase transition, where one has large fluctuations, one has long autocorrelation times, critical slowing down is the term that's often used associated with it. So the specific heat of the gauge Gaussian model is predicted to diverge with this square root singularity as the Hagedorn temperature is approached from the deconfined high temperature side of the transition. If we look at the other side, the word counting problem gives us, we get the sub-leading corrections, the 1/n corrections, one can evaluate them. And this is if I take just this product here, these are the 1/n corrections in the large n limits, the leading large n 1/n corrections taken without constraint on the length of words. And it's well described by n equals one, just I need to take only n equals one term here. And it gives us this expression here, but you see that at beta equals beta h, the exponential becomes one and the partition function diverges. This feeds back into the free energy as a logarithmic dependence of the free energy, or a divergence of the internal energy as the Hagedorn temperature is approached. It diverges as one would, but this divergence is coming from 1/n² corrections. The 1/n² corrections diverge as the Hagedorn temperature is approached. And for T in smaller or in the neighborhood of this t 2ta squared over n squared md to the transition, the one over m squared corrections are comparable and start to dominate over the ground state energy. A key point is that the key lesson from this is that fluctuations are large. And but if one goes back and looks at the word counting problem again, and one restricts the words to length less than n squared, which is reasonable, it removes this divergence, but it doesn't remove, it removes the actual divergence, it cuts it off. And one can, if one chooses the coefficient to be 1/4 here, it smoothly matches to the high temperature phase. Let me just skip that actually. A similar analysis for the BMN model. Now we can just go back and include fermions. Fermions are again Gaussian, one can integrate them out. One gets exactly the same model, but the term A1 has changed. There's a fermionic term, which is this 4 minus beta mu over 4. You recall that the mu over 4 was the fermionic mass term. And this one has a Hagedorn temperature and a Hagedorn transition at 12 log of 3 over mu. Aside from that, the analysis is identical. Once one parameterizes this in terms of the of A1, and A1 can be written in as a function of beta and beta Hagedorn, then the specific heat, the conclusion is that the specific heat of the large mu BMN model also diverges at beta H. This is true of the bosonic BMN model as well. If we drop the fermions, one can add or include or not include the fermions. In that case, the temperature is this one. You see there's a small difference, and the effect of fermions is to suppress the Hagedorn temperature. If there are any questions, I'm happy to take them at this point. Okay. And let me go back to the BMN model. The BMN model, as we saw before, I've expanded out these terms to comment on some other aspect of it. If I look at just this red part of the model, one can see that it provides a nice matrix model, which is a pure matrix model on its own. And it has a low temperature phase with non-trivial fuzzy sphere vacua. This is a Myers term. Oops. Ah. Sorry, I should use my... There's the ground state of this term on its own is xj is equal to minus mu over 3. And we can, and these are fuzzy spheres. Do I want to say any more on that? No. Okay. Let me describe now briefly how this model is put on a lattice. I won't go into a lot of detail in it. But what one does is one can think of this, the part that needs to go on the lattice, all of the fields, X's and the psi's, will be put on the lattice sites. We've just got a time lattice, a Euclidean time lattice from 0 to beta. And we put them, our psi, the fermions, and the gauge fields on the lattice sites. And we find a difference, or Laplacian. This can be represented in terms of a Laplacian and a Dirac operator with a mass term. So one goes to a finite difference operator, and I've included the gauge field in D. So these become standard link variables, and the bosonic Laplacian can be approximated by just the leading term, or if I want to improve it by tuning the parameter RB, one can kill the quartic term if I choose RB to be 1 over 12, one can kill the quartic term in the expansion at low momenta of this. And that's an improved lattice version. The lattice Dirac operator is more subtle. The lattice Dirac operator was just the ordinary derivative, d tau. And it is an anti-symmetric matrix. And when one finite differences it, one gets, if I, the term R is equal to zero is a leading lattice Laplacian, lattice Dirac operator. But with this finite differencing, one gets fermion doublers. To remove the fermion doublers, one should add a Wilson theorem. The Wilson theorem is a symmetric object. It's Laplacian and Laplacian squared. So I must accompany it by some anti-symmetric Clifford algebra element to get an anti-symmetric matrix. The charge conjugation, this, and we're dealing with the Clifford algebra of SO9, or spin 9. The charge conjugation matrix in that case is symmetric. The C times gamma I are anti-symmetric. Pairs of C times gamma ij and the commutator of two of them, this is an anti-symmetric, or three of them are anti-symmetric, and one can continue through it, but the only non-trivial ones are these. And the only choice for sigma 1, 2, 3, or for this Wilson Clifford algebra element is some linear combination of these two elements of the Clifford algebra. The simplest choices are, I've told them, sigma 1, 2, 3, which one means anti-symmetrizing three gamma matrices, and anti-symmetrizing two is W12, gamma 1, 2. This choice, sigma 1, 2, was chosen by earlier authors. I think it was originally introduced by Simon Catterall and followed through. And when we began, we started using that as well. The integration out of the fermions leads to a Pfaffian, the Pfaffian of this Dirac operator and this Pfaffian of the lattice Dirac operator. That potentially could have a phase, and the phase for the Pfaffian would be a serious problem. It would mean, if the phase is far from zero, it would mean that your Monte Carlo simulations are not going to work. You've got to do something much more subtle. If it's small, you could try reweighting. If it's getting large, then you have a sign problem in the model. I'm showing you here, by just measuring explicitly the Pfaffian phase, that it is very narrowly distributed around zero. So the Pfaffian phase is not important. W123 K6 is one choice of with W123 as the parameter. W123 SUSY is a choice of parameters which makes the fermionic the bosonic Laplacian and this and d dagger d of the lattice Dirac operator the same, including Wilson fermions. So they become identical. And as you see, the phase is more or less the same, that it isn't a problem. If I use the original choice of Catterall and Hanad and Nishimura and collaborators, then the phase is still not so much of a problem, but it's significantly larger. You see, it's centered at zero, but the standard deviation is almost 0.1, whereas we're down to 0.002 for these ones. Making the lattice spacing larger, taking more lattice points, computing Pfaffians is expensive numerically. The Gaussian becomes narrower. So the phase of the Pfaffian is not a problem. It also is independent of the mass parameter, including mu in the simulations does not appear to change the distribution of the phase. If we look at the BMN model, it has, one can study it as a function of this mass parameter mu. I described it for very large mass parameters. As we go down along to smaller mass parameters, I've described it here for mu equals 6. One can see that there is a Myers transition. This is a transition where fuzzy sphere phases blow up. Right? And it blows up at, for this parameter value, the temperature is 0.69. You see what has happened here is I'm plotting the the expectation value of the trace squared of the 9 individual matrices. This is trace of xi, xi, and normalized appropriately. And 6 of them are fluctuating around one value, and 3 of them, well, as the simulation progresses, this is Monte Carlo time on this axis. As the simulation progresses, it fluctuates between different fuzzy sphere configurations. A small fuzzy sphere, a large radius one, and these are going to be determined by the Casimir of the fuzzy sphere configuration. One can see that there is a separate phase transition at a lower temperature. This is 0.05, below 0.05 at the temperature. I've put the two transitions here. There are two phase transitions in this model. One associated with this at this temperature. I'm plotting it on the energy. You can't see it very cleanly in the energy. This would require much larger matrices and more refined study to try and see anything in this, but these two observables are telling us where the transition is. The Myers transition happens here. The Hagedorn confining deconfining transition happens here. And if one looks at the phase diagram, one can map it out. At high temperature, I've taken the phase transition coming directly from the Gaussian model with perturbative corrections. It's given here. The gauge gravity dual and gravity computation was done by DeCosta et al. I should have included that reference here. I'm sorry about that. And they found that it had a transition which is given by this red one. I have taken a purple one here, which is a Paddy approximant that interpolates between the two. And the numerical data for the two transitions at large mu, there are two transitions, as we discussed, and the data I showed you was for this point here, and it was these two, which should be a 0.6 and 0.5, roughly. And as you go to lower temperatures, it looks quite complicated, but it appears to be merging with the gauge gravity dual. Are there any questions at this point? Okay, then I will continue. The gauge gravity dual predicts that the strong coupling regime of the theory is described by type 2A gravity, supergravity, and supergravity Lagrangian. It has the gravity term and the four-form field. The dual, in the case of the BMN model, has the four-form field is turned on. I won't really go into discussion of that. It's a much more complicated situation. I'm going to focus for the rest of the talk on the BFSS and what we can learn about the BFSS by studying the Birkholz-Douglas model. The BFSS corresponds to ND0 brains, ND0 brains in type 2A theory. And solving for the gravitational metric in that setting, one gets a metric ds squared in terms of the one function h, which has alpha naught the number of d0 brains over r to the 7. to try and match with the gravitational system, one should include a black hole. The black hole provides it has a Hawking temperature. The Hawking temperature should be matched with the temperature of the gauge field, 1/beta of my previous transparencies. And we, as a comment, Hanada and Nishimura et al. Commented that they expect that at low temperatures, due to Hawking radiation, that there should be an instability of the supersymmetric model, this particular model, the BFSS model. And it is known that it has, and this is related to the flat directions that are preserved in the supersymmetric setting. Supersymmetric preserves, it cancels the small fluctuations which are lifted in purely bosonic models by ground state, by the zero point fluctuations of the bosons. These are cancelled by the fermions and one's left with flat directions. And at sufficiently low temperatures, one sees that the BFSS model radiates. I think that's probably not the right interpretation of this, but that was one of the suggestions, because this is lifted by the mass term in the BMN model. You don't have that instability. It is, of course, recovered. It comes back to, again, at very small mass parameter. So when one includes the black hole geometry, the metric becomes a little bit more complicated. There's a time dilation factor. There's this F to the minus one written in terms of these rescaled variables, U naught and U, which is R over alpha primed. And one's interested in taking the alpha prime goes to infinity limit to suppress the stringy corrections. And the temperature, one can work out the relation of the temperature to the geometry from the Hawking, Bekenstein-Hawking formula. It's given by F primed and appropriately corrected, and it gives this exponent to the 5/2. Black hole entropy, we can relate Legendre transform it to the energy which we were computing, and the energy, the parameter lambda can be absorbed into T, and I've done that. The T that I was describing was really T over lambda. And we get this non-trivial exponent of 14/5. Now, these were my observables, which I don't need to go into. If one looks at the numerics, quite a few different groups have studied the numerics of this model, trying to take it and push it to as low a temperature as possible. And the best that has been done so far is to compare these ones, and I've given you the errors taken from Berkowitz et al. In 2016. And the coefficient here is coming from the theory, but one can match, if one assumes the exponents, all of these exponents, then one gets, and if one assumes this correction here, one gets these numbers rather precisely. One can test how well one gets it by relaxing some of these. One can reproduce this number 7.41 with reasonable precision if one assumes other quantities, but it's essential to assume the exponent. If one assumes nothing with regard to trying to fit the data, one gets very little information. One can fit the data by something like, I forget, it's pi times t squared or something like of that nature. So, this I would say is a significant success in comparing with the gauge gravity duality, in that one is able to recover numbers that come from a string theory computations, at gravity dual computations, which is quite impressive. But one would like to be able to do much more. And I would say we need more suitable probes of the dual geometry. And one of those probes is to, one can think of it from the geometry point of view, to take D4 brains and put them into the geometry. all of the D0 brains are sitting at the center of the black hole, and now one is going to take these four-dimensional spatial planes and intersect them with that black hole geometry. And this is the D4, D0 intersection. If I take the number of D4 brains to be very small, then they won't affect the geometry significantly, and one can treat them as just a probe on it. I've rewritten the phi part of the Berkus Doublex model again here, just to point out to you that these ones are n times nf. Nf is the number of four brains, and n was our original gauge group. And we're adding this term to the Lagrangian and its supersymmetric partner. The fermionic fields are again here. You see we've again, this should be d tau. It's the same d tau as I had earlier. And we have essentially the same ingredients. The fermions are a little bit more subtle. The model is much more delicate than the BFSS or the BMN model because of these details, but it's still, one can put it on a lattice. The same discretization works. It's a little bit more subtle, but when it still works. Let me just skip this. One can study the bosonic version of it. Again, it's qualitatively the same. One can study it in a probe limit. One sees that it doesn't affect the basic observations that much, and one can measure properties of the the scalars, the new fundamental scalars that are entering the model. But I want to draw your attention to two new observables that play an essential role. One wants to, sorry, I should have gone back to this one for 1 second. There's one point here. One of the points, one can introduce a mass term for the scalars for phi. And it's when it's zero, the D4 brain is centered. This is a diagonal matrix, and it's just a constant MA, and it's SO5 vector, so there's only really one mass term in it. And it's telling us the displacement of the D4 brain away from the central plane of the of our geometry. So we can, if we put it at zero, then we are placing our D4 brain on axis, and it should intersect with the black hole in the same plane as the black hole. The black hole is in that plane. If we move MA away from zero, then we can use this MA to probe the geometry. We can use the D4 brain and move it away from the black hole. We can move it out past the Schwarzschild radius and further on. And we can study what happens. One can study what happens in that context by changing how the field theory responds to changes in this mass parameter in M. So we're sending X to X minus MA. Again, we can look at the bosonic one. It has, we understand how to understand this in terms of this Hagedorn gauge Gaussian type models that can be studied. But one of the new observable that comes in here is the derivative with respect to the mass, dc, dm. This will be a susceptibility. Sorry, there was one other one was dc. This is the observable itself. This is the condensate. One expects a condensate associated with phi. And one can study how that condensate responds to the change in parameter. If I go back to the gravitational setting, one can work out what the dual geometry, the effect on the dual geometry is by putting the D4 brain as a probe on this background geometry. If I'm putting it as a probe, then a reasonable description of that is in terms of Born-Linfeld action. It's a membrane in terms of Born-Linfeld action here. And F is zero, and for the case we're interested in, break up the geometry appropriately, and one gets will get a profile for this D4 brain geometry. If one looks at it as a varying M, this mass parameter, M out here at infinity, we're varying it, M equals zero. As we go out along, we can study the profile, and you see that something interesting happens. There's a phase transition, and one is predicting a new phase transition in the model as one passes the black hole. One, when the D4s are falling into the black hole, and when they're departing from it. And one can study that, and one gets a detailed prediction for what that condensate is, match it with the field theory. I just did, it was this expansion of the profile near infinity. One gets this C tilde, and one can measure it, and one can simulate it. It agrees, as you can see, surprisingly well with the predictions of the profile. As one is approaching the edge of the D4 brains no longer fall into the black hole, one has this phase transition. So there's a different setting here. And this is showing up in the numerics. Again, this is for a relatively small system. This is not an incredibly detailed analysis of what numerical analysis. It's time consuming, but it was done in 2015, and it needs to be revisited. We are returning to this at the moment. So I think I'm more or less out of time. So I'm just going to give you some conclusions and ask for questions. I would say the Berkus-Douglas model does provide a rather powerful tool for probing the geometry. One can do much more. The simulations agree rather well with predictions. I just looked at it in the probe limit. Of course, one can extend the analysis to the to beyond the probe limit, where one has F being of the same order as N. This requires for to a comparison with the geometry to get a full D0, D4 intersection. And we have recently worked out some of the details of that. That's coming from the 10 and 11 dimensional supergravity picture. So thank you for your attention. It's difficult to know whether there's anyone there or not when nobody says anything.
Benjo, maybe we can take some questions.
Yeah, I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, I'll wait for other people to ask before I have some questions which I'll ask you. So maybe I can just start off. So you discuss about this deconfinement transition in the BMN model. So do you also see the signs of the transition? Did you look at the free energy in the BMN model?
The free energy from the lattice point of view?
Yeah. Because there's an argument that there's a free energy zero from the paper by Costa and Panadonis from 2014.
Well, we compared with the energy, the internal energy of those ones. That was this Costa et al. It's their red curve. They've got it's a line basically, because they did first order perturbation theory essentially around around the BFSS situation.
But do we get a power law dependence for the free energy in this case? Did you check that the free energy satisfies a power law behavior, which is expected from the gravity calculation?
It's, it is returning to the same power law as the BFSS. As you, when you turn the mass to zero, yeah, well, I mean that's the BFSS computation. There is
but at finite mu, is it still true at finite mu that the coefficients and other things remain the same as BFSS? If I take finite mu,
oh, we didn't study it in detail. No, okay, we were mostly tracking the. There's a phase transition which messes things up. In the BFSS, there's no phase transition. One's always in the same phase. One can continue down towards it. But here, once you go to small mu and you vary the temperature, you are going to cross a phase transition. So you can't really go to small mu without also reducing this mass parameter.
I see. Okay.
So the real difficulty is if you go down along a line of constant mu, you are going to cross this transition. Now, unless it ends at some point, but it looks like what we believe happens is that the two transitions merge around 3, or a little, probably even closer to 2, and then there's a single transition below that, and you are crossing that phase transition, which messes things up.
Okay. And one more. For the D0, D4 system, which you discussed, which is the deformation of the BFSS model, do you still have the same power law dependence of the energy?
Yes, you do. This is just a probe on it. Okay. It's the number of the... four brains are the number on the in F, the size of the matrix. It's a non-square matrix and is kept much smaller than the number of colors. So the number of fundamental multiplets is kept very small. And we actually studied it for just a single multiplet, which is the smallest one can have. And that acts as a probe. And one can see that it has very little effect on the adjoint variables. So that's more or less as one would expect.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Maybe I can again ask if there are any more questions from the people who are still there. Yeah. If there are no questions, then. Are you saying something, Denju?
No, that's okay. I'm happy to answer questions or not, as the case may be. Maybe it was a little off theme for your for people. I hope I didn't. I hope it was clear at least.
Yeah. No. Yeah. It's okay. I think it was fine.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.